I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. On Tuesday, the Obama administration announced that it had uncovered a plot to murder Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the United States. Attorney General Eric Holder said the plan was directed by officials in the Iranian government and high-ranking members of the Quds Force. It allegedly involved an Iranian-American who's a used car salesman recruiting an assassin from a Mexican drug cartel to carry out the attack. Yesterday, President Obama addressed the issue and the skeptics at a news conference.
This is part of a pattern of dangerous and reckless behavior by the Iranian government. One of the principles of international behavior is that our diplomats, we send them around the world, that they are going to be protected. They are not targets for threats or physical violence. For Iran to have been involved in a plot like this indicates the degree to which it has been outside of accepted norms of international behavior for far too long.
Mr. Obama called for the toughest sanctions against Iran. Iran has denied the allegations. This is just one of a number of news stories from and about the Middle East and North Africa, and that's our topic for today's Radio Times. And let me introduce our two guests. Michael Duran is the Roger Hertog Senior Fellow in the Brookings Institution Saban Center for Middle East Policy. He specializes in Middle East security issues. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense under President George W. Bush. He joins us from their studios. And Michael Duran, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here. Good morning.
Good morning. Also with us is Brian Katulis. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where his work focuses on U.S. national security policy in the Middle East and South Asia. He has served as a consultant to numerous U.S. government agencies, private corporations, and non-governmental organizations. And Brian Katulis, nice to have you with us as well.
It's great to be back with you.
Nice to have you back. Let me begin with this whole Iranian situation. Brian, if I can begin with you. And there is some skepticism in this country about whether this was the plot that the Obama administration has described. Do you have any reason to doubt what the president said, what Eric Holder said, and what Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton has said?
At the present time, no. I have a little skepticism at all. I know I've seen it out there, and some of my colleagues in other think tanks and others are raising questions, but I've not seen anything that would challenge sort of the indictments and the case that's been built here. And it seems a little, you know, crazy, the
yes.
plot itself,
yes.
and quite odd. But when you look at how Iran has acted for several decades now, as odd as the plot is, it's not outside of sort of rationality for how they might operate.
What do you think, Mike Duran?
I agree totally with Brian.
So the idea, and I'll just sort of break it apart here and I'll toss it to you, Mike, which is the idea that Iran would plot to kill the Saudi ambassador to the United States in the United States using a used car salesman and someone from a Mexican drug cartel. That doesn't seem outlandish to you?
Well, it seems a little amateurish for sure. But I think the level of specificity that the president and the attorney general gave us regarding the plot suggests that we have very solid intelligence about the flow of the money, about the connections into the Quds Force, and so on. One assumes, I don't have any information, but one assumes that that's signals intelligence and that it's really very clear, showing the line all the way back. I don't think the president would want to take risks with his own reputation and make those kind of statements if he didn't really have something very solid to back it up. So I have no reason to disbelieve it. The question then is, why would they take the why
exactly.
why would the Iranians take such a risk? And if you think about it, if it had been successful, it would have looked very daring, audacious, and we would have felt very vulnerable, because we would have seen them working through Mexican cartels to get it right, you know, into the nation's capital. They may also, we can just speculate. They may also wanted to have sent a message to us that they have the ability to do this kind of thing. Now, why they would have wanted to do that, mm-hmm. I mean, we can go into further speculation if you want.
Well, I don't mind a little further speculation, only because it does seem like the most bizarre episode of something like 24. Let me go back to you, though, Brian Katulis, and the president talked about sanctions. What options does the U.S. have to deal with this planned plot?
Well, I mean, first, obviously, is the legal option, and they're prosecuting that pretty aggressively. There's a lot of talk about ratcheting up the sanctions that already exist, and I think the previous administration, the Bush administration, started to do this in its second term in particular, and Obama picked up where they left off in sort of trying to isolate Iran for a number of reasons, not only its support for terrorism, but also its very troublesome nuclear weapons program. And I think they're looking at a range of options of even sanctioning Iran's central bank. The questions, though, you know, and Michael may know a little bit more about this in terms of details, how much all of these sorts of sanctions will actually deter other sorts of plots. When I was in Pakistan last week visiting there, there was an incident that people were talking about in May where a Saudi diplomat had been killed, and there were similar sort of allegations that the Quds Force or some elements of Iran were behind that. So, you know, even with ratcheted up sanctions, I think the question is this enough, and will we be able to deter sort of the networks of terror that Iran uses to try to assert itself?
Mike, do you see this as an act of war, as some have said?
I do, and I completely agree with what Brian just said. I think if you look at the usual set of tools that we have to deter and dissuade the Iranians, they're not going to work. I'm sure that we can bring more pressure to bear through the international sanctions route. We may be able to move the Russians and the Chinese a notch this way or that way. We may be able to get the Germans and the Italians, who have significant economic interests with Iran, to do a little bit more on the margins, and it will cause the Iranians some pain, but it won't bring them to the point where they're going to actually sacrifice the things that matter to us the most to us, and that's the support for terrorism and the nuclear program. So, just as Brian said, the question before us is: do we consider now? Do we rethink our entire strategy and consider taking unilateral actions that might actually dissuade them and deter them, or do we continue to allow ourselves to be attacked in this way? And I see this as part of a pattern of Iranian behavior. They support proxies against us in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Lebanon, and elsewhere. And I think a long time ago they decided that they were at war with us and wanted to drive us from the region. So the question is, do we just assume that we're going to continue accepting this level of threat from them, or do we want to actually do something to change it?
Well, let me pick up. You used the word unilateral action, obviously, the U.S. working alone. Are you suggesting that the U.S. should have a military response to this plot?
It doesn't necessarily have to be military. I think there's a set of covert intelligence activities that we could carry out as well. I mean, since 9/11, we've put together a very powerful apparatus for combating Al Qaeda and like-minded movements, which includes a whole array of activities, including financial activities that the Treasury Department oversees, and mainly, I think we have used that tool against al-Qaeda. And I think the question that the president is going to want to consider is whether that sort of four-star strategic asset that we have developed for going after al-Qaeda should be turned on the Iranians.
What do you think, Brian?
Well, I think to a certain extent we're already involved in a covert war with Iran, and it's been taking place largely in Iraq. Recent news that militants trained by the same Quds Force have attacked U.S. forces. This has been sort of an ongoing story for the duration that we've been in Iraq since 2003. So there has, I think, been unilateral action already taken. We don't talk about it that much. It comes out every once in a while, but quite clearly, I think one thing, you know, the war with Iraq had huge sort of impacts on the strategic architecture of the broader region of the Middle East, and I think it's much debated whether that's been good for the U.S. or negative, but one thing that's been pretty clear is that Iran has, on the one hand, felt encircled by the presence of U.S. forces and a little bit threatened, but then also emboldened. And I think, you know, this goes back several decades, too. I think Iranian-sponsored terror groups have attacked the U.S. and many of its allies. So this is, I see this sort of latest incident in this plot in this longer, steady stream that goes all the way back to 1979 and the Islamic Revolution in Iran. And we've sort of had a covert war against them and vice versa, and it'll likely continue.
Brian, one of the allegations or charges from the Obama administration is that if the Quds force is behind this alleged plot, then it had to have been approved by Iranian leadership, maybe Mahmoud Ahmadinejad or the Ayatollah Khomeini. Can we go that far, do you think?
I'm not privy to the intelligence that would substantiate that. You need certain levels of clearances there. So I need, as an analyst, to take that at face value. And from what I hear from a number of people in government, people I talk to regularly, they seem to have pretty credible sources that demonstrate that, as crazy as this plot was, it had some sort of sanction at fairly senior levels. Don't know, though, how high it goes up.
Of course, back in 1953, Michael, the U.S., the U.K., cooperating in an operation that overthrew Iran's president Mossadegh. So it's not as if we're, you know, totally clean when it comes to this kind of stuff.
These are the realities in the region. The Iranians are conducting these activities against us, and so I think the question is, you know, what do we want to do about it? If I could just pick up with what Brian said about them, about the responsibility of the Supreme Leader for this. I think that there's sort of two separate questions you need to think about. One is, what do we know in terms of information? How far do we want to push that in terms of speculation? And then what do we do about it strategically? So, and the president kind of hinted at this yesterday or suggested it when he said I think the word he used was operational responsibility and then accountability. So we may have intelligence. I'm not privy to it, but we may have intelligence that takes us back to somebody within the Quds force. That's apparently what we have. Then there's the question of, is that individual operating independently, or is he reporting up the chain to Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Quds force, the head of the IRGC? And then the next question is Qasem Soleimani then briefing the Supreme Leader? And at a certain point, the clarity that you have about what's being told up the chain isn't very clear. So you have to make an assumption. Either this guy's a rogue actor or he's actually reporting up the chain. The intelligence people are always very careful to make sure that they don't claim to know something that they don't have direct evidence for. But I think you can assume that if you can't assume that he's being reported up the chain, you still have to hold the Iranian government accountable for everything that comes out of it.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Michael Duran and Brian Katulis. 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
ChristianaCare Health System Center for Heart and Vascular Health supports WHYY. Studies show experience makes a difference in patient outcomes. Recognized by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, ChristianaCare cardiovascular surgeons perform more than 800 open heart procedures each year, and the team of heart specialists treats more than 8,000 total heart and vascular patients annually. ChristianaCare, with locations in Pennsylvania and Delaware. More online at christianacare.org/heartleaders.
I'm Marty Moscowane. We're in the second day of the fall membership campaign, and we want you to be a supporter of WHYY. Take just a minute or two and call 1-888-345-9499 or go to WHYY.org and pledge online. Where does your money go? To support programs like Radio Times. Today we're doing a roundup of the news from and about the Middle East and North Africa. We have the time on Radio Times to go in depth. That's why we do the show, and that's why you listen. 1-888-345-9499.
Lancaster City Arts is proud to support WHYY. Lancaster City Arts, 125 art venues, all within one walkable community. From galleries, art studios, museums, and an art college, to music, poetry, dance, photography, professional theater, and symphony, it's an opportunity to experience something different in an art scene that's quite unexpected itself. Lancaster City Arts. The journey starts online at lancasterarts.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe. Again, we are talking about news from and about the Middle East and North Africa. We're beginning with the Obama administration's accusation that Iran had plotted to assassinate the Saudi ambassador to the United States. We do want to talk about Egypt and Libya, Syria, Yemen, Israel, and Hamas, if we can squeeze all that into our discussion in this hour of Radio Times. Our guests are Michael Duran, and he's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution Saban Center for Middle East Policy, and Brian Katula is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. And lines are open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Brian, I hear both of you and Michael are essentially supporting the Obama administration in their accusation of this plot. But the skeptics point to, frankly, the Bush administration about the yellow cake and Niger accusations and stories involving curveballs, saying that intelligence just cannot be trusted. Is there reason, though, for skepticism based on the track record when it comes to intelligence, especially in that part of the world?
Well, look, anytime you have raw intelligence and information, you could always have hasty conclusions and mistakes can be made. The standards for evidence, though, I think in our system of law are much higher here. So that's why I'm a little bit skeptical about the skepticisms. I'm not totally dismissing it, and I actually think it's an interesting debate that I see some of the analysts at think tanks and people are having in the media. But on balance, based on what I've seen and the discussions I've had, the specificity and the facts, as odd as they seem to be credible at this point. And I think it's fair in a democratic society, especially given mistakes, not only the mistakes that were made over the last 10 years with intelligence, but quite repeatedly. It's a type of business where you're prone to make mistakes because you're relying on partial bits of information. And I think, you know, we need to be careful about drawing hasty conclusions. I don't think they've drawn a hasty conclusion on this specific instance, best that I can tell.
Well, and are you saying because these two men have been charged in a New York federal court, the fact that it was taken that far means that the evidence is perhaps better than it was in the past?
Yeah, I think so. And again, as odd as sort of the details of this plot seem, there's nothing that I've seen with this specific instance that leads me to question this, and this is based on what I've seen in the open source. But then again, repeated discussions I've had over the last couple of days with people at the White House and State Department and others, and it's I think they've built a pretty strong case here. Let's see if it'll hold up in the court of law, and I think it might.
Michael, I'd like to hear from you. Then I do want to move on to some of the other countries in the Middle East and North Africa.
Sure, I agree with what Brian said. I just add to that there are a number of different pieces to this. We have a money transfer. We have two individuals, and we've been tracking the interaction apparently between them, and so on. So it's not just like a guy appears and tells a story, and we're believing the story. I mean, we seem to have tracked individuals engaging in actions that we can trace right back to Iran. So that's the thing that really suggests to me that this is well founded, and plus the president has come out and staked his reputation on this.
Yeah.
I don't think he would have done that. I don't have so much skepticism in our system to think that he wouldn't have done that without very good information.
And I think one of the concerns, Mike, and then I do want to get to some callers, is that this would lead us to another war.
But that's a big worry, and I mean that's when the president looks at the options that he's got, he has to worry about the retaliation from Iran. We're vulnerable in Afghanistan. We're vulnerable in Iraq. They could define Saudi Arabia as part of a plot against them and attack Saudi Arabia and disrupt world oil flows. And the risks are huge here. And if I could pick up on something Brian said before, what's the mindset in Iran that produced this plot? And I think it's probably a combination of audacity and sense of rising power combined with a great sense of threat and fear against the background of the Arab Spring. I mean, they feel very vulnerable, and they see that their best ally in the region, Syria, is tottering on the brink. They see their nuclear scientists are being assassinated. They have other internal problems, which often we have no hand in whatsoever, but they trace that back to us. So they feel very vulnerable. At the same time, they see that that our appetite for staying in the region is declining, and they think that the Saudis are vulnerable as well, and there's a regional contest between the two of them. Mm-hmm. And I think that combination of a sense of opportunity combined with tremendous vulnerability on the part of the Iranians puts them in a very dangerous mindset. And the president has to think very carefully as he calibrates his steps forward.
Let me get a couple of callers in, and then I do want to talk more about the Arab Spring and the rest of the Arab world. But let's get Joe from West Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Joe, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi there.
Are you there?
I am. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I think we need to really focus at this time on American intelligence and its report card, its record, on misinformation, misleading, using media, using...
Oh, I think we lost Joe, but I know where he was going with this. It's something that we touched on earlier. And Mike, if I can go back to you, you were in the Bush administration, and there's just a lot of, I would say, and Joe speaks to this, a lot of suspicion and skepticism when there are reports of intelligence, and especially a report as seemingly bizarre involving the possible terror attack in the United States and what the U.S. should do in response.
I would make two points. One, I would say that even if this is totally wrong, it's still right.
In the sense that
it's part of a pattern of behavior on the part of the Iranians that is really well established. They're using proxies mainly in the Middle East, not so much. I mean, what's new here is that they're doing it on our homeland, but they have been involved in facilitating the killing of Americans in the Middle East for years, and so there's the signs, if you wanted to look for them, that we have a problem with Iran are great, including, you know, recently the Obama administration came out and said that that Iran is cooperating with al-Qaeda and facilitating activities of al-Qaeda in the region. So there's a whole host. The case against Iran is extremely strong, even if this particular case didn't hold up. But I also think in this particular case, like I said before, I'm assuming the intel is very strong. And you know, when you go back and you look at the scorecard on the intel, and you say, well, what about Iraq WMD? Well, the fact of the matter is, we had some very good intelligence that was about Iraq WMD that was analyzed incorrectly. But Saddam Hussein was carrying out a deception in order to deter Iran, wanted Iran to believe they had a WMD program. And many of the top officials in Saddam's military believed that they had, that Iraq had a WMD program. So we were picking up all kinds of signals from Iraq about their WMD program. Now we analyzed that incorrectly, mm-hmm. but this is the kind of capability, this signals intelligence capability that we have, which is incredibly powerful. And in this particular case, if we have that kind of information about the interaction between these two individuals, then I think the possibility that we've got it wrong, that a wire transfer came from Iran, that an Quds Force official was in contact with an American citizen, and so on. I think the possibility that we got that wrong is pretty slim. And when you add up all the other factors, the possibility that, it doesn't somehow go back to the Iranian government also seems to me to be slim.
And that's Michael Duran from the Brookings Institution Saban Center for Middle East Policy. Also with us, Brian Katulis, a senior fellow at the at the Center for American Progress. And we are talking about events and news from and about the Middle East and North Africa. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me just pull back a little bit. And Brian, let me go back to you. How much do you think the Arab Spring has redrawn alliances and or influences in the Middle East and North Africa? I realize it's a very broad question, but I want to sort of pull out our lens a little bit here and look at the region.
I think it's had a tremendous impact, and the Middle East has entered a transition period that I think will likely take years and maybe even the rest of this decade to unfold. We're not likely to have full clarity about the full implications of the changes underway. And I've likened this to sort of, I've called this the fourth major strategic shock to the Middle East since 1979, the Arab Spring. And I think the implications, it's going to be very hard to see how things will settle itself because they're very interesting alliances. But the first three shocks were the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran. I think the 1991 Gulf War reordered the region and reordered the U.S. approach to the region, and then 2001 with the start of the global war on terrorism under the Bush administration. This fourth sort of strategic shock coming from the changes in Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, changes partially underway in Yemen, some rumblings in Bahrain, and then, of course, the unresolved situation in Syria. There's a lot that's up in the air, and the region is realigning itself. And I don't, you know, I think any honest analyst, I've lived in the Middle East, I speak Arabic, spent about 5 years in the Middle East. I think any honest analyst cannot predict what sort of region we will have 3 or 4 years from now, just because there's so many complex forces and different trends underway in individual countries. But what we've seen, you know, is a broader trend towards people wanting more of a voice in their governance. And this has been for a long time. But I think what happened in Egypt and Tunisia has opened up something that I don't think we're turning back from. But what this means in terms of the relationships between countries in the region and then our strategic relationships with key partners, you know, it's difficult for me to predict where we might be 2 or 3 years from now in 2015.
Mike, I'd be curious about your response, and I realize we're talking about a region with individual countries and individual relationships with the United States, but does the U.S. need to rethink its kind of overall approach to this region of the world?
I think it needs to it needs to think about what its role is in the changing Middle East. If you go back to just before the Arab Spring, look at it in terms of the relations between the states, there was a kind of a pretty stable system, or a system that looked like it was pretty stable, and that was Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, and Hamas making up one alliance system against the United States and its allies, who in the Arab world were the major ones were Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, United Arab Emirates, so on. And that looked like a pretty stable kind of balance between the two. I mean, there was a lot of give and take, but no one was expecting this Arab Spring, which has hit both sides very hard. So you've got now the Saudis feeling very vulnerable in Bahrain. The Saudis feel when they look at this contest with Iran, they feel like they lost Egypt, or at least there's a big question mark over Egypt now. And the Saudis are very angry with the United States about having pushed Mubarak out. So the Saudis, for a while, they clamped down and they said no more revolution after what happened in Egypt. And for a while, they were sitting on the sidelines in the Syrian question once the uprising began in Syria. But then, at a certain point, they switched and they said that they were striking a balance between. Or looking at the clash in their interest between a desire for no revolution, for obvious reasons, you know, for a kingdom, and the desire to get at Iran. And they decided at a certain point that Assad was going to go down and that it was a good thing for Saudi Arabia if he did, because as a primarily Sunni country, They thought that the new order in Syria would work to their advantage. So they turned against Assad. So if you look at it as like the Saudi scorekeeping, they think, well, we kind of lost Egypt, but we might gain Syria. And in the Iranian scorekeeping, it's just the opposite. But the wild card in all this is Turkey. Because Turkey has come in with a kind of independent policy to try to, as a kind of a jackal in a way, to pick up all the pieces and establish itself as a sort of major new player. And so it's searching for a role, and it's not clear whether it's going to come in on the Iranian side or the Saudi side or whether it's going to triangulate between the two. And we need to think about what, in terms of relations between the states, what new order do we want to see? And how much are we willing to play a forward role in creating that order? I think if we sit back, as we've been doing, and just wait for the order to emerge, we're not going to see anything anytime soon come out of this.
Well, and there's so many countries to talk about, but let me take Syria. And, Brian, I'll go back to you. As we know, there have been calls from the United States and others for the President Bashar al-Assad to step down. He has not done this. The U.S. Ambassador, Robert Ford, is essentially standing with pro-democracy groups. He's been attending funerals. He's been attacked. He's been the face of the United States in this particular country. What do you think the U.S. should do, or is there something more the U.S. can do to put pressure on the Assad government?
Well, first, let me slightly disagree with something Michael said, but I not fundamentally disagree. I don't think the Obama administration has been sitting back and watching events. I think when you just cited Ambassador Ford being very forthcoming and sort of standing with the protesters, and this was an ambassador whose his appointment was held up in the Senate because of a certain ideological approach to diplomacy, and as we're seeing, Ford has been one of our most strongest tools in a very limited toolbox here. And I think in Libya and in other cases, the Obama administration has been quite active in trying to shape things. I would, though, agree that our approach has largely been tactical, and it's been reactive and in this crisis management mode. I think that's been the case for Middle East policy for decades. For a long time, that much of how we've approached the region has been in a reactive mode. There are different episodes, including in the Bush administration, where we advanced a vision for freedom, which I largely supported. But then, you know, when we there was a lot of rhetoric there, but then wasn't sort of fully implemented clearly. So on Syria, you know, on your specific question on Syria, I think the Obama administration has tested and pushed the limits of what can be done at the United Nations. And as we see, certain countries like Russia, China, which have commercial interests and a different view of Syria, won't support that. We also see that the government in Baghdad, the Iraqi government, which we've supported, U.S. taxpayers have supported to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars, standing up solidly behind the regime of Bashar al-Assad. I think we can do more to support the democratic forces, and I met with some of these individuals, Syrian activists, yesterday here in Washington, who have been organizing mostly in Turkey and looking for international support. The sort of things that were done quietly behind the scenes with the Libyan rebels and the opposition, I think we need to do more and offer the best sort of support we can, tailor it to their needs. I think the one thing that the Obama administration has done largely right was to make sure that these political changes, the democracy changes, weren't seen as some sort of U.S.-led crusade, which I think, unfortunately, that I think was one of the downsides of how we approach things under the Bush administration. You know, I lived in the Middle East at that time, and there was this strong desire for freedom and democracy in the Middle East, but the way we went about doing it was perceived by many of the civil society activists, and this is a complicated thing, but it was perceived as something that the U.S. is doing for its own interests. But as we see now, I think the most effective thing is to provide the sort of quiet support and try to nudge these changes along as opposed to force them in some sort of way.
That's Brian Katulis joining us along with Michael Duran. We are talking about the Middle East and North Africa and U.S. policy there. You can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art supports WHYY, presenting Rembrandt and the Face of Jesus, the first exhibition in Philadelphia ever to include the rare paintings of the great painter of the Dutch Golden Age. Rembrandt and the Face of Jesus features more than 50 paintings, prints, and drawings, some for the first time in the United States, and also reassembles a group of tender portraits of Christ that have not been seen together since they left the artist's home in Amsterdam more than 350 years ago. Final Weeks closes October 30th. More info at philomuseum.org.
I'm Marty Moscowain. We're in the second day of the fall membership campaign, and we want you to be a supporter of WHYY. Take just a minute or two and call 1-888-345-9499 or go to WHYY.org and pledge online. Where does your money go? To support programs like Radio Times. Today we're doing a roundup of the news from and about the Middle East and North Africa. We have the time on Radio Times to go in depth. That's why we do the show, and that's why you listen. 1-888-345-9499.
Support for WHYY comes from Friends School Haverford, a Quaker co-educational preschool through 8th grade school in Haverford, Pennsylvania, minutes from Center City. Since 1885, Friends School Haverford has been committed to providing an education that inspires the imagination and challenges the intellect. Academic rigor, a micro-farm with egg-laying hens, and a social curriculum based on respect and kindness are just a few of the hallmarks of their program. Walk-in Wednesday tours every week at 9 a.m. Details at friendshaverford.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain, and if you're just joining us, our guests are Brian Katulis. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Michael Duran is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution Saban Center for Middle East Policy. We are talking about news from and about the Middle East and North Africa and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I do want to put some other countries on the table, but first let me go to Jahan, and he's calling us from Cherry Hill. Jahan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi. I just have a couple of comments. One is in regard to the name Iranian and Iran. Please be careful with that name. If you're going to name Ahmadinejad and Khamenei, we have nothing to do with them. And every time the Iran comes back on the news, my kids, who one of them goes to high school, the other one goes to university, they get nervous about that. The second comment I like to add is that, don't you think this story, whether it is true or not, bring the Saudis and Israelis closer to each other? After all, enemy of my enemy is my friend, right? Thank you.
Well, Jahan, thanks for calling in to Radio Times. I'm not sure I totally got the second point. The first point is he's an Iranian-American, and he's concerned when news like this is news that his family might pay the price. But I guess the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Michael, I guess that gets us in part to some of the alliances within the Middle East that we've been talking about.
Right. I thought his first point was actually a good point. If I slipped into that, mm-hmm. I do apologize. I mean, I think it's really the Quds Force, the Islamic Republic, the Supreme Leader. These are probably better terms to be using because the mass of the Iranian people don't support what the Iranian government is doing. With regard to the enemy of my or the enemy of my enemy is my friend. It's been a feature of the strategic landscape for a long time that the Israelis and the Saudis have the same interests with respect to Iran. I don't know exactly what conclusions he wanted to draw from that. The possibility of there being a kind of cooperation between the Iranians and the Saudis and the Israelis is slim to none, however, because although they do share that same hostility to Iran and concern about its growing influence in the region, there still is the Arab-Israeli conflict that divides them.
Brian, picking up on that, interesting, a prisoner exchange is negotiations going on between Israel and Hamas. The exchange of the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit, and he's been held for about 5 years now for something like 1,000 Hamas prisoners. What's the significance, you think, of this, and even the timing of this prisoner exchange?
Well, it comes at a time where direct negotiations between the Palestinians, represented by the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, and Israel have been moribund for more than a year. And the Palestinians, obviously, the PLO leadership went to the UN General Assembly to try to unilaterally declare its own state. So it comes at a time where things are really frozen between Israel and the other Palestinian leadership. And, on the specific deal I know it's very controversial, especially the 1,000 that may be released, and many are really responsible for deadly violence. But I hope, I mean, one of these things, I really hope that Gilad Shalit comes home, because it's been, as you said, 5 years, more than 5 years, and it's just amazing to think that he's been held this long in Gaza. So it demonstrates that there's some movement. It also demonstrates that through Egypt and other interlocutors, there's a very active conversation ongoing between Israelis and Hamas on core issues. I don't expect that this will lead to any major openings in the peace process, which has been, I think, dead essentially for the last couple of years, in part because of how Israelis and Palestinians view their strategic interests, in part because of mistakes that I think the Obama administration made in how it handled this. So I think this potential deal, because it's not been consummated yet, could lead to some positive things. Obviously, getting Gilad Shalit released could lead to some possible, you know, new sorts of security threats. I don't know the full list of who's going to be released of the 1,000. But at least there's something moving here after years of not much happening that's been positive.
And do you think, Michael, this will in any way affect the relationship between Hamas and Fatah?
I think the strategic implications of this are very interesting. I have to get into a little bit of speculation here. But one of the fascinating things that's happened since the uprising in Syria is that a split has developed in Hamas, because Hamas has taken the side. Hamas's external leadership is resident in Damascus and has been closely aligned with the Iranians and the Syrians. And Hamas has taken the side of the opposition, or at least it has refrained from supporting the Syrian government against the opposition. And at the same time that that's gone on, the Egyptian government has become more comfortable with the, as a result of the ouster of Mubarak, has become more comfortable with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and therefore with Hamas, because Hamas is historically is an offshoot of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood. So what's happened as a result is that Egypt has grown closer to Hamas, and Syria and Iran have grown farther away. Hmm. And what the Israelis seem to have been doing here, one of the reasons that they seem to have made this deal, is in order to strengthen the Hamas-Egypt connection, because the Egyptians played the role of mediator here. So in a sense, Netanyahu handed the Egyptians more influence and more authority with respect to relations with Hamas. And I assume that they did that. This is speculation on my part, but I assume that they did that with an eye toward Iran. That to the extent that they can pull Hamas away from Iran, develop fissures within that alliance of Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, and Hamas, the better for Israel in general. But also, there's been a lot of speculation lately about the Israelis planning some kind of action against Iran.
Let me get Ben from Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Ben, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Great. Thank you. Great conversation.
Thank you.
I have one comment, which actually sort of brings us back to the Syria-Iran in relationship with the Soviet Union and China. I was curious to know from your guests how they feel it would be possible for the Obama administration to somehow, maybe not exact concessions from Russia or China, obviously, but maybe move them towards more broader consensus in the Security Council, as Syria and Iran seem to be having their own domestic problems.
Well, let me toss that to you, Brian. I guess the question being, does the U.S. have leverage when it comes to the Soviet? Well, it's not the it's Russia now, I guess. It's not the Soviet Union. Russia and China.
Well, they've been trying very hard. I think, again, the challenge is in this day and age, countries, particularly those that have a permanent seat on the U.N. Security Council, can throw their weight around. And I think Susan Rice, our ambassador at the United Nations, have been trying very hard with her counterparts up there. I don't know that at a presidential level, you know, what's been done in the last couple of weeks to try to nudge them on both Syria and Iran. I know there was a very, very heavy lift done by the president in the White House to ratchet up some of the sanctions on Iran related to the nuclear program, and I think that's a good thing. You know, essentially, I think we lost several years in the previous decade when Iran was moving forward on its nuclear program, and we didn't really have much of a strategy or a policy to try to contain it in a serious way. But that's the challenge right now, I think, and Michael had mentioned this too, in relation to how the U.S. wants to project itself in the Middle East. I think trying to really determine how much power and leverage we have, not only with other global powers like China and Russia, but also in the region too, you know, and really assess pragmatically how much when we say we want to do something, we can actually get it done. There's this efficacy challenge that I think started to bubble up over the last 10 years when we repeatedly said we were going to do certain things and didn't achieve it. And I think the Obama administration is trying to realistically assess what it can get done. And I think it's probably quite limited at this stage on Syria with Russia and China because of their commercial interests and other things. But then I think the plan B will be then what is some sort of coalition that can be assembled, what can be done through key partners like Turkey, which I think is pivotal on Syria, to continue to ratchet up the pressure on the Assad regime and isolate it.
And I do want to talk about Libya, but let me first get Michael from South Philadelphia to join our conversation. Michael, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. I have a quick comment, and then I'll take the answer off the air.
Sure.
To the gentleman from Brookings, I think it was, who said earlier regarding American intelligence services, something to the effect that regarding Iran, that even if we're completely wrong about Iran, we're still completely right. Does he have any sense of how idiotic that sounds?
And what do you mean by that?
I'll take my answer
don't leave us, because why do you say that? Why does it sound idiotic to you?
It sounds like here's a man over here that we think he's about to, we have evidence that he's going to murder somebody, we're going to accuse him of this. But now it turns out that we're completely wrong, we don't have the evidence, and none of it holds up, but we're still right because he's a bad guy because we say so.
Oh, fair enough. Let me give Michael Duran a chance to respond. Michael, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Michael, go ahead.
Okay, thanks. well, first of all, I actually do believe that there's a lot of evidence there. But I was just saying that even if all that evidence evaporated, my point was we have an enormous amount of evidence about Iran conducting a covert war against the United States with the intention of weakening it in the region. And I think the vast majority of Middle East analysts would agree that Iran is arming and training proxies and providing them with capabilities in order to cause damage to the United States and to kill Americans. That was my point. I don't want to have to stake my argument on one sentence I made.
Well, and I wonder, Brian, just and you know, there's so many important countries to focus on, but just picking up on that, whether, and we know that there are protest movements within Iran. Do you, as you imagine or even look into the future, do you see changes coming from within that country or from pressure from the United States and other countries from without?
I think there are very brave Iranian people who have risked their lives and then some who have lost their lives for the fight of freedom in their own country. We saw that in 2009 and throughout, and it continues. And I actually think that there's a certain inevitability here, I think. The system in Iran is decrepit, and I don't think will sustain itself. How long it'll take, and I think the collapse from within may come quicker than many people suspect. Added to that, these sorts of pressures that it feels from the outside, the economic sanctions and the isolation. And I think Iran, especially under President Obama, has become isolated even more. I think one positive consequence of the Obama administration's approach to Iran, it tried first to engage, reached out, and was slapped back. Mm-hmm. I think this gave the world the sense that all of the problems that the Tehran regime was pointing to and trying to point the fingers to the United States and the Bush administration, I think what demonstrated to the rest of the world, President Obama, that Iran is really the problem here. And I actually, you know, foresee a scenario at some point later this decade that the current powers that be in Iran won't be there anymore, in large part because their people will be sick of the system, and there's just so many great Iranians, millions of them, who want a different change, and you have a new generation that's inevitably going to come to power. Will it be simple? Will it be overnight? No. Will we be the ones that are driving it? Absolutely not. We can nudge it along with other partners in the international community. But I when you look at sort of the trends in places like Iran, the current status quo just won't maintain itself.
And that's Brian Katulis joining us along with Michael Duran. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
Good morning. I'm Eugene Son, audio news director here at WHYY. I'm here with Debbie Builder, a producer for Radio Times with Marty Moss-Cohen, and we're asking you to call in and pledge and support Radio Times at 888-345-9499. That's 888-345-WHYY. Of course, you can pledge online at whyy.org. We're cutting into just a few minutes here in the first hour of Radio Times, and we'll have a whole second hour coming up shortly as well. But it's the perfect time for you to take that little breather from all the stimulating conversation about the Middle East and make that pledge. 888-345-9499.
Hi. There's been so much turmoil in the Middle East, it's impossible to keep up with it all. And I really appreciate these conversations where they put all the news in context. I mean, Marty's talking about the recent assassination plot, Syria, Libya. I mean, all these countries, so much is going on, and it's really difficult to keep up on it all. An hour like this with two really intelligent guests, sort of deep analysis of an issue catches you up on that. You're a listener. You appreciate what Marty does. Give us a call and become a member, 1-888-345-9499.
One of the things I love about Marty's show and Radio Times is that when they take on heavy issues such as this, they don't do it in a kind of eat your spinach kind of way. Hey, you got to pay attention to it because it's important.
No one would listen
if you did that. Yeah, exactly. They bring it alive. They bring people on who are good talkers, good explainers. So it isn't an eat your spinach kind of situation. It's something that you want to listen to, even if it's not necessarily a subject that you would pick out for a show yourself. If you appreciate that kind of stimulating dialogue and with the chance to chime in with your own opinions here on Radio Times, please call and pledge. The pledge line is 888-345-9499, or if you're online, whyy.org.
You know, next year it will be the 25th anniversary of Radio Times. Marty has been doing this for 25 years, 500 shows a year. It's really remarkable. We bring you all different kinds of topics. I've been working with her for a long time, and I don't think I have ever seen her walk into an interview unprepared, not informed, not engaged. And I know as a listener, you hear that every day. That's what brings you to the radio. That's what makes you turn it on, or your computer, or your podcast, however you listen to Radio Times. That's what you appreciate. That's what you know you can count on day in, day out, the range of topics. Give us a call. Become a member. Support this kind of programming, 1-888-345-9499. You can also go online and pledge at whyy.org.
I've heard Marty say that it's ironic that her job requires so much homework, so much reading and preparation, because she said when she was in school, homework wasn't her forte, as it were.
Yeah.
But you can hear it in the shows. You can hear it because she's read the books that the authors have written. She's done all the prep work, so she can ask the second and third level questions, not just the topical breeze through it kind of questions. If that's the kind of programming and probing questions that you rely on here on Radio Times, please call and support it.